And this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Susan Shand, and Jill Robbins. Later, Ashley will bring us the next part in our series on America's national parks. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Some scientists say there is growing evidence that yearly booster shots may not be needed to protect people against COVID-19. Vaccine developers have been advising that the world will need yearly booster injections to remain protected. Vaccine producers have also suggested that new vaccines might be necessary to fight new virus versions, also called variants. But these suggestions were disputed by more than 12 influential disease and vaccine development experts who recently spoke to Reuters news agency reporters. Some of the scientists expressed concern that public expectations around COVID-19 boosters are being set by drug company executives rather than health specialists. Still, many agreed that preparing for such a need as a precaution was reasonable. The scientists fear that a push by wealthy nations for repeat vaccination as early as this year will deepen the divide with poorer countries that are struggling to buy vaccines. In some nations, it may take years to vaccinate their citizens even once. We don't see the data yet that would inform a decision about whether or not booster doses are needed, said Kate O'Brien. She is director of the Department of Immunization, Vaccines, and Biologicals at the World Health Organization. O'Brien said the WHO is forming a group of experts to examine available data on virus variants and the effectiveness of vaccines before issuing advice on future vaccination programs. The chief of Pfizer, Albert Bourla, has said people will likely need a yearly booster of the company's vaccine to keep high levels of immunity against COVID-19 and its variants. Such a booster would be similar to yearly shots many people are urged to get to protect themselves against influenza infection. Dr. Tom Frieden is the former director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He disagrees with that idea. There is zero, and I mean zero, evidence to suggest that that is the case, he told Reuters. It's completely inappropriate to say that we're likely to need a yearly booster because we have no idea what the likelihood of that is, Frieden added. Frieden is now head of the international public health campaign Resolve to Save Lives. Pfizer reacted to the criticism by saying it expects a need for boosters while the virus is still spreading widely. That need could lessen when the pandemic is more fully controlled, a company spokeswoman said. Moderna CEO Stefan Bancel said his company aims to provide a vaccine by the autumn that targets a variant first identified in South Africa. He said he expects repeat boosters will be needed. The United States is preparing to have booster doses available for Americans. The European Union, Britain, and Israel have ordered new supplies of COVID-19 vaccines to deploy as protective boosters. Some health experts say vaccine makers are right to plan for boosters since no one knows what will be needed in the future. Richard Hatchett is the chief executive of the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, which has financed many vaccine projects. He told Reuters that if the vaccine producers have the doses on hand, governments can then decide for themselves whether to buy the products. I'm Brian Lynn.
Ayazuddin Hilal worked as an interpreter alongside U.S. soldiers on hundreds of patrols and firefights in eastern Afghanistan. He earned a medal recognizing his work, and an American commander also praised his efforts in a letter. But when he asked for one of the few special visas that would permit him to go to the United States, he was told no. Now, as American and NATO forces prepare to leave the country, he and thousands of others who worked with American troops are afraid. They fear they will be targeted by the Taliban. "We are not safe," the 41-year-old father of six said. "The Taliban is calling us and telling us, 'Your stepbrother is leaving the country soon, and we will kill all of you guys.'" The future of interpreters after the troop withdrawal is one of the many uncertainties surrounding the withdrawal. Will the Taliban return? Will women lose the rights they have gained? Will the country's security situation worsen and terrorist threats rise? Interpreters and other Afghans who worked for the U.S. government or NATO can get what is known as a special immigration visa, or SIV. The visa program was created in 2009. It is similar to a program that was created for Iraqis. Both SIV programs have long received criticism. The paperwork is long, with security concerns slowing the process even more. The pandemic has made the whole system even more difficult. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said last month that the U.S. is committed to helping interpreters and other Afghans who aided the war effort. Many, he said, took great risks to help the U.S. The Biden administration has launched an investigation into SIV programs. Investigators are looking at reasons for the delays, as well as possible corruption and other issues. Former interpreters are becoming increasingly public about what they fear would happen under Taliban leaders. "They absolutely are going to kill us," Mohammad Shoaib Walizada said after joining others in a protest in Kabul. He is a former interpreter for the U.S. Army. At least 300 interpreters have been killed in Afghanistan since 2016, The Taliban have made it clear they will continue to be targeted, said Matt Zeller. He is a co-founder of No One Left Behind, an organization that works for the rights of those who aided the U.S. Army. He also served in the country as an Army officer. The Taliban considers them to be literally enemies of Islam, said Zeller, adding, there's no mercy for them. Members of Congress and former service members have also urged the U.S. government to fix the CIV process, which now takes more than 3 years. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said last week that the U.S. Embassy in Kabul had increased employees to help with the visa requests. In December, Congress added 4,000 visas. That brings the total number of Afghans who can come with their family members to 26,500. About 50% have been given out, and 18,000 more have been requested. Critics and those who work with refugees said the need to help Afghans could sharply increase if the country falls into chaos. As it is, several warlords that were supported by the United States and NATO threaten the country's future, along with the Taliban. Afghan security forces are weak and poorly equipped to fight both threats. Noah Coburn is an expert on Afghanistan at Vermont's Bennington College. While praising the Biden administration's attempts to fix the system, he told the Associated Press he thinks the entire program needs to be rebuilt. If they are not willing to sort of rethink the entire thing, they are not going to actually start helping those Afghans who are most at need, Coburn said. He estimates there could be as many as 300,000 Afghans who worked for the U.S. or NATO in some form over the last 20 years. Recently, there have been killings of Afghan government workers, reporters, and others. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for some of the deaths, while the Taliban and the Afghan government blame each other. Former interpreters have support in Congress, in part because many also have the support of former American troops. Wali Zada, for example, provided a letter of support from an Army sergeant who worked with him in many patrols, including one where the interpreter was wounded by Taliban gunfire. I cannot recall a linguist who had a greater dedication to this country or the coalition cause, the sergeant wrote. I'm Susan Shand.
House of Representatives on January 4, 2021, Representative Emanuel Cleaver of Missouri closed a prayer to mark the swearing-in of the 117th Congress. He changed the traditional Amen and instead said Amen and a woman. Amen contains the sound men, but it is not connected to the English word men, meaning adult males. The men from Amen is from the Hebrew word meaning truth. The word is used at the end of a prayer to signify agreement with the prayer's message. But it also can be used to show agreement to the truth of any statement. The representative's words show the desire among the members of Congress to use gender-inclusive language. He may have thought the word Amen excluded women and changed it in the same way we would say men and women of the military. In grammatical terms, gender refers to how many languages divide mainly nouns and adjectives into one of three groups. The groups or categories are feminine, masculine, and neutral. Feminine means related to the female sex. Masculine means related to the male sex. English does not use grammatical gender. Our words, however, do often speak directly to biological gender, a state of being either female or male. In America, increasingly, people are seeking to avoid language based in biological gender. The House Committee on Rules announced rules for the new Congress in January. The new rules demand language changes to avoid terms considered sexist or discriminatory in other ways. The Rules Committee explained that their goal in writing the new rules is to include all those who work with Congress and their families, including those who are non-binary, identifying as neither male nor female. The words they chose to avoid include such words as father, mother, son, daughter, brother, sister, uncle, aunt, nephew, niece, husband, wife, grandson, or granddaughter. Instead, the rule calls for using parent, child, sibling, parent's sibling, sibling's child, spouse, or grandchild. These guidelines only restrict Congress's documented language. The use of gendered words in speech is not part of the new rules. This was evidenced on January 13th, when Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, opened debate on impeaching President Donald Trump using gendered language. I stand before you as a wife, a mother, a grandmother, a daughter, Pelosi said. A daughter whose father proudly served in this Congress. The new House rules also identified words to be used in connection with job or occupational positions. For example, the leader of a committee will be described as the chair. Words such as member or delegate replace the pronouns she and he. And herself or himself is replaced by themselves. Changes like these are becoming more common. In 2019, several language expert groups named they both the word of the year and the word of the decade. The American Dialect Society named my pronouns the word of the year for 2019. Colin Surname, a singer and songwriter who lives in Britain, has written a song to teach us about using the singular pronoun they.
Singular they is really easy. Singular they is here to stay. It's been around since 1350, and it's a word you already say. Think when you don't know someone's gender, so you refer to them as they. I just did it when I said them then. What a convenient display.
And that's Everyday Grammar. I'm Jill Robbins.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Today, we visit one of the most unusual national parks in the United States. It is called the Dry Tortugas National Park. It includes seven small islands. They are about 200 kilometers off the coast of the state of Florida. One of the islands was once a prison. The first European to see the small islands was the Spanish explorer Ponce de León. He arrived by ship in 1513. Ponce de León was an older man who was searching for special water that stories said would make him young again. It was called the Fountain of Youth. Ponce de León named the islands the Tortugas. Tortuga is the Spanish word for turtle. Thousands of turtles lived on the islands. Ponce de León was able to capture many of these creatures to provide meat for his ship's crew. He never did find the Fountain of Youth. In fact, the islands had no fresh water on them at all. The tortugas were dry. The word dry began to appear on early maps of the area to warn ships that they could not find fresh water there. Centuries later, America's third president, Thomas Jefferson, took an interest in the islands. He hoped they could become a place that could help protect ships traveling in a large area of water called the Florida Straits. He proposed a military base be built there. In 1821, the United States took control of Florida and its islands. Construction of a military fort began in 1848, long after Jefferson's death. The fort was to be the home of 1,500 men and 450 huge cannons. The fort's name? Fort Jefferson. Fort Jefferson was never really completed. It had to be worked on continually. The salt air, wind, water, and sand quickly caused problems. The weight of the fort's heavy brick walls made them sink into the sand. Slaves and prisoners did the building and repair work at the fort. Many of the prisoners were army troops. They had been found guilty of crimes and ordered to serve their sentences at Fort Jefferson. In July of 1865, four new prisoners arrived at Fort Jefferson. They had been found guilty of taking part in the successful plot to murder the President of the U.S., Abraham Lincoln. One of the prisoners was sentenced for giving medical aid to the man who killed President Lincoln. He was also found guilty of being an active member of the assassination plot. That man was Samuel Alexander Mudd. He was a 32-year-old doctor from the state of Maryland. He was sentenced to spend the rest of his life doing hard labor at Fort Jefferson. The walls at Fort Jefferson were about 15 meters tall. Inside the walls of the fort were hundreds of rooms. Most of them held guns that pointed out to the sea. Many other buildings were also inside the huge fort. No prisoner had ever successfully escaped from Fort Jefferson. It was more than 200 kilometers across open ocean
to the nearest occupied land. Samuel Alexander Mudd must have believed the fort would be his home for the rest of his life. But he was wrong. In 1867, Dr. Mudd was helping the prison doctor treat victims of yellow fever. Many people died from yellow fever. Soon, the prison doctor lost his own battle with the disease. Only Dr. Mudd was left to treat the increasing number of men who became sick with yellow fever. Later, the sickness seemed to leave the island. Many of those who survived knew they owed their lives to Dr. Mudd. Almost every man in Fort Jefferson wrote to the President of the United States, asking that Mudd be pardoned because of his work treating patients with yellow fever. They called Mudd a hero. In February of 1869, President Andrew Johnson signed a presidential pardon. Mudd was a free man. He left Fort Jefferson and returned to his home in Maryland. He once again became a family doctor. In 1874, the American Army left Fort Jefferson. Modern artillery made the fort no longer useful. Today, the old fort and empty little islands provide a protected home for thousands of birds, fish, and sea turtles. Visitors travel for hours on high-speed boats that bring them to the islands from Key West, Florida. They swim in the warm waters and enjoy the bright Florida sun. Many try snorkeling or scuba diving to explore the underwater shipwrecks. Still others bring tents and spend a few days living on the white sand beaches. Thousands of visitors make the trip to the Dry Tortugas National Park every year. Of course, soldiers no longer greet them when they arrive at Fort Jefferson. Now, friendly members of the National Park Service do. They meet every boat filled with visitors. They smile and say, "Welcome to Fort Jefferson and the Dry Tortugas National Park." The small island's days as a prison are long past. Yet, almost every visitor to the park asks about its most famous prisoner, Dr. Samuel Alexander Mudd. They ask to see his room. Most people know that the doctor did not end up spending the rest of his life in the Fort Jefferson prison. Only a few of the huge cannons remain at the park. They help show visitors what the old fort looked like. The weather continues to affect the fort's grounds and buildings, so workers continue to fight against environmental damage. The park extends over an area of more than 26,000 hectares. Almost all of this is ocean and living coral reefs that protect the islands. Many ships have sunk in the waters around the islands over the centuries. The wrecks of these ships help provide safe places for many fish. Thousands of kinds of fish live in these waters. Some visitors are even lucky enough to see sea turtles swimming in the clear blue waters. Dry Tortugas is also home to many seabirds. Visitors are not permitted on some of the islands within the park to protect birds that are laying eggs. The striking natural beauty and relaxed feel of the islands today seems far different from Dry Tortuga's earlier history as a lonely, inescapable prison.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.